This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher have been joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, from podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome. Our guest tonight is Professor Jim Flynn, and our show is hosted by Professor Samuel Mann and myself, Shane Gallagher. Now, because we have yet another amazing guest tonight, we're going to skip our usual pieces and go straight to our interview. And so our guest tonight is Professor Jim Flynn, and he's the Emeritus Professor of Political Studies at the University of Otago. He's possibly best known for discovering the Flynn effect, which is the name given to a substantial and long-sustained increase in intelligence test scores measured in many parts of the world. The term itself was coined by Richard Hermannstein and Charles Murray, authors of The Bell Curve. And Professor Flynn is originally from Washington, D.C. and was educated in Chicago, and he emigrated to New Zealand all the way back in 1963. Professor Flynn campaigns passionately for left-wing causes, and in 1967 he served as the chairperson for the Congress of Racial Equality, a civil rights organization in the U.S. South, and in New Zealand he became an initiating member of both the New Labour Party and of the Alliance. He was an advisor to Labour Prime Minister Norman Kirk on foreign policy, and he has studied for parliamentary candidates in general elections here on several occasions in Dunedin. Professor Flynn has authored numerous books, book chapters and scholarly articles, and he's currently working on a book on climate change, which we'll be talking to him about a little bit later. And his 2010 book, The Torchlight List, proposes the controversial idea that a person can learn more from reading great works of literature than they can from going to university, a copy of which I have right here beside me. Welcome to our show. So, tell me, Jim, you were brought up, you were born in Washington, D.C.
Yes, I was born in D.C. in 1934. I'm just had my 80th birthday.
Congratulations. And so what was it like growing up in Washington back then?
Washington, D.C., before World War II, its major industry was the federal government, and you hadn't had the enormous expansion of the federal government that occurred during World War II. It was a town of about 400,000, which means not much bigger than Christchurch. It was a semi-southern town. You still had segregated schools when I was a schoolboy. Even our church, while not entirely segregated, I know the pastor discouraged blacks from attending St. Paul's, and they were supposed to go to St. Augustine. St. Augustine was a black saint, of course. And often black Catholic churches were called St. Augustine. So it was a semi-southern community, racially divided, not a very fast-paced community. As I say, there's very little industry there. It's mainly the federal government and spin-offs of the federal government.
So you were a contemporary of Noam Chomsky, and he came from a very politically active family. Was your family politically active?
They were. My father was politically aware, but he was not a political activist. He was born in 1885, and he hated what he called the rich, the plutocracy. He had gone into factory work, like all the older members of my family, between about the ages of 11 and 15. And he went to the Rumsey Sickemeyer bedspring factory, where he worked long hours, and In 1900, when he was 15 years old, the boss put up a sign which said, if this county goes for William Jennings Bryan, you'll be locked out for 2 weeks. And they voted for Bryan, and they were locked out for 2 weeks. He thought that socialism, though, you just couldn't sell it. There weren't enough socialists. But he was a left-wing Bryan Democrat and remained so throughout his life. And he became... He was self-educated, of course. He didn't finish, really, I think, as much as junior high school, or you'd call it an intermediate school. But he was self-educated. He read very widely, and he was always moderately left in his opinions, pro-trade union, pro-democratic party.
And was this kind of, so a new community, was it an active community? Was it, did you have a...
It was a mixed community. A lot of people lived... It was centered on a park near where I lived. It was called Meridian Hill Park. And to the south of the park were mainly blacks, though not entirely. They came pretty close to the park. The southern boundary of the park was Florida Avenue, and that was sort of the boundary with White Washington. But there were pockets of Filipino, Puerto Rican, Italians, Irish. Our parochial school drew on all of these except blacks. That is, Leo Amiducci was a friend of mine, Louis DeLallo, they were Italian. There were plenty of Irish in the school. Tommy O'Brien, Benny Soul was a Filipino. And it was a mixed racial area. I don't think it was politically active in any particular way. It was very mildly gang organized. No place for kids to play. You could play in Meridian Hill Park until the police kicked you out. But this meant it was important to defend your right to play there, and blacks controlled the lower half of the park and various white groups the northern half.
Sounds quite exciting. So what led you to go to university? Was that something that your parents wanted
you
to do?
My brother did. He would have been the first one. I can't think of any prior generation who went to university. My Uncle Ed had only about a sixth grade education, but as a seaman during World War I, he read books by torchlight, and he was one of only six able seamen accepted for officers' candidate school. So he had educated himself to the equivalent of a college education, but he had little formal education. And he parlayed that after the war. He managed to get into law school and take a law degree, and so did my Aunt Myrie. But my Aunt Myrie, being a girl, had finished high school. My grandfather was too proud to put out girls to service. The boys could go into factory work. So she did have a high school education, and in those days, you could study privately for the bar exam and pass it. So the older generations of my family didn't have the equivalent of a university degree in a formal sense. But my brother, he went off to Georgetown University, and that made it seem normal for me to go to university.
And which university did you go to?
I went to the University of Chicago on scholarship.
And what was that experience like?
It was a very politically active place. During the McCarthy period, you know, the McCarthy period came along with the Cold War, and it got particularly intense once the Korean War began in 1950. That's when McCarthy began his persecution of the left. Well, I went to the University of Chicago in 1951, and it was one of the few politically active campuses during the McCarthy period. Even Berkeley wasn't very active. In New York City, the city university was, because it drew on the New York population, and many American radicals were concentrated in New York City. But it would have been one of only about two politically active campuses, and I was very active on the campus left.
And what were you studying there? You studied...
I went there, since at school about the only thing you required you to think was mathematics or physics. I had gone there with the intention of being either probably a theoretical physicist. And my brother, who was a chemist, encouraged that. But once I got there, I decided that doing pure mathematics was too much like being a chess grandmaster. I wanted something with a human slant. And fortunately, they forced everyone to take a general curriculum, no matter what you were going to do. And I decided that I would major in some branch of philosophy. And I chose political philosophy, which meant I took a degree in politics. And for many years I regretted I hadn't done it in philosophy proper, but as I matured as a philosopher, I decided the most important ethical problems could only be solved by a combination of philosophical analysis and knowledge of social science. So to be trained as a social science was actually, as a scientist, was actually an asset.
So you then started working on... when did you start working doing your work on intelligence?
Well, my original lifelong interest for almost all of my academic career, as I say, I'm 80 at present, until I was about 65, I was deeply engrossed in the question of how you could defend humane ideals in the light of reason and evidence. I, of course, had been raised a Catholic, but I'd broken with the Church long ago. And I wanted to find some non-religious way of defending humane ideals. And my book, Fate and Philosophy, that came out a few years after The Torchlight, a list has the solution I arrived at. But it's based on a book that was published in the year 2000 called How to Defend Humane Ideals. Really, the psychology was an added field. When I was writing How to Defend Humane Ideals, I wanted to argue with people who were racist, to show how you could use reason and evidence against them. And I stumbled across Arthur Jensen, who was not a racist, but he did think, on the basis of evidence, that blacks, on average, had inferior genes for intelligence to whites. He thought that in equal environments, only about the upper 25% of blacks would overlap with the upper 50% of whites. Well, of course, even that was enough to refute classical racism, and that they want to persecute all blacks. But I thought I would devote about a chapter to the subject and ended up writing a book called Race, IQ, and Jensen that came out in 1980. And in it I argued that the evidence showed that the notion that blacks had inferior genes was dubious, that it was more probable that environmental reasons were the reason for the black IQ deficit. And while researching that book, I happened to look at U.S. military tests because they showed significant IQ gains over time on military tests. But these weren't taken seriously because these weren't thought of as true IQ tests. And I thought, well, I wonder how much they differ from real IQ tests, and started looking in the test manuals. And while I didn't find any reference to military tests, I discovered material in the Wechsler and Stanford Binet IQ manuals that clearly indicated IQ gains over time. So beginning in about 1982, I had a second field to ethics, and that was trying to first show the world that this was really true, and that took a while, but they all came on board. And then a much more difficult task was getting them to revise their theory of intelligence to take it into account, because these gains were far too great to be determined by genes. They had to be determined by environment. And, of course, at that time, the notion that environment could seriously raise intelligence was suspect. So I had to eventually show that these gains did amount to a gain in our ability to solve cognitively complex problems, and that the prevailing theory of intelligence was mistaken. And the book I first published in 2007 with Cambridge, entitled What is Intelligence Beyond the Flynn Effect, essentially was the culmination of that, though I published several books since. So I really had two careers, one in ethics, which culminated in about the year 2000, and one in the theory of intelligence, which culminated in 2007. And since then, I've been more interested in writing books that help the general public address the complex world around them. And, of course, one of these is certainly the problem of climate change.
What was the reaction to your, in 1980, to that book?
Which book now?
The 1980 book.
Oh, I think that many people, including Jensen himself, felt that I was the only person who, on scientific grounds, approached his views. Mainly people just heaped invective on him. They wanted to beat up his children and bomb his lecture room. And, of course, this is ridiculous. If you think someone is wrong, you marshal the facts to prove they're wrong. you don't start persecuting the individual, you show that there's evidence that he overlooked. And I think the 1980 book was, in the opinion of most people, the only respectable refutation of Jensen. And therefore, it gave me a certain reputation. Now, of course, it was not universally accepted. Jensen was never convinced, although he and I were on friendly terms. I mean, we agreed to disagree about the evidence, but we didn't question each other's integrity. I, however, was attacked for publishing the books by the far left, who said that even debating this issue showed you were a racist. Now, of course, what made them upset was that once you admit that an issue is evidential, it's always possible that future evidence will turn against you. So they wanted, incredibly enough, to make this question one that science couldn't possibly address by specious argument. And, of course, that was really disreputable. Obviously, you can eventually hope for evidence that would show either that blacks in an environment equivalent to whites score as high on IQ tests or they don't. And some of the evidence I brought to bear was Eifert's study in Germany, where the children of American black servicemen and white black servicemen with German women scored virtually identically on IQ tests. Now, that seemed to indicate that having a black father was not a handicap. But it didn't settle the debate, because the Army gave IQ tests before it would admit people into the Army. And some suspect it did this largely to screen out blacks. But more blacks flunked the tests than whites. And I did calculations which showed that while the black fathers were an elite group, they wouldn't have influenced IQ by more than 3 points. So the study seemed to indicate that blacks were no more than 3 points inferior, which is not worth much. I mean, twins are 4 points inferior to singletons. But moreover, blacks didn't have an entirely racist, non-racist environment in Germany. I mean, Hitler, of course, railed against the blacks as much as he did as the Jews. And if a woman had a black baby, a German woman, she couldn't conceal that she had slept with the enemy, while a white woman with a child from a white serviceman could just move to another town. So there was considerable evidence that even in Germany, blacks had a tougher row to hoe that could easily have accounted for the 3 IQ points. But I also pointed out that in Germany, there was no such thing as a black subculture. If you were a dark-skinned German, you were just a dark-skinned German who looked sort of like a Turk or an Italian. And I thought of that as terribly significant, that persecution seemed to lower black IQ by only 3 points, while the missing black subculture raised it by 12 points. And then I did a very careful study of black subculture in America, and in my book, Where Have All the Liberals Gone, in 2008, I analyzed it and showed why I thought it, in the American context, put blacks at a conceptual disadvantage. I won't go into that book in detail, but one of the most important studies was Elsie Moore. She had kids, all of whom were black, and half were adopted by white professional parents and half by black professional parents. And the black mothers had 16 years of education, just as white mothers did. And back in 1980, that meant they were a big elite. And further, the fathers of both white and black were either professionals or sub-professionals. And despite the fact that all the adoptees were black, by the age of 8.5, those adopted by black professional parents were 13.5 IQ points below white. So clearly there was something ingrained in the black subculture that being a professional or even being a university graduate did not allow you to give your children as conceptually a rich environment. Well, of course, she was immediately attacked for blaming the victim and all of this sort of nonsense. But, of course, you can't cure a problem unless you diagnose it. She called mothers in with their children to work on IQ-type questions. The white mothers were almost entirely encouraging. Oh, that's interesting. Try this. The black mothers were almost entirely censorious. You're not that dumb. You can do better than that. And clearly there were subtle influences within the black subculture that discouraged intellectual achievement. Now, I think I also published material that showed that over the last generations, blacks have gained 5 points. So whatever those factors are, they do seem to be diminishing. But it's stupid to say you're a racist if you think a subculture can prevent a group from advancing. My group, the Irish, was at a very strong disadvantage compared to Chinese Americans. For one thing, farms in Ireland were only one-third the size or one-sixth the size they were in China. And Chinese grew rice, they grew a variety of crops, they sold silk, they had silk. The Irish, who came to America, their farms were so small that the only thing they could survive on was breaking them exclusively over to potatoes. And they didn't even live in a money economy. Irishmen on the West Coast who found a dollar note would take it to a pawn shop to get silver for it. He didn't recognize it as legal tenure. The Chinese had an educational tradition. If a kid was bright, he could go through the Chinese examination system and become a mandarin in favor of the village. Under the penal laws in Ireland, no Catholic could go to school. They were uneducated. You couldn't even, if you're a Catholic, send your child abroad to be educated. So we came to America with no entrepreneurial skills. We didn't even have farming skills. All you do with potatoes is turn them over twice a year. And yet all the Irish went to big cities where they were faced with an urban culture they'd never encountered before. The Chinese had an educational tradition. They believed in education. As I told you, in my father's family, my grandfather sent all the boys out to work by the age of 14. In a Chinese family, they stayed in school. Further, the Irish, while they had nothing to do all year, had plenty of cheap potato liquor and developed alcoholism to a degree unheard of in the Chinese community. It's estimated that in 1900, alcohol was a greater curse in Irish communities than drugs are in black communities today, that over 50% of fathers were violent or abusive. So it's absurd to think that culture, subculture, has nothing to do with intellectual or educational attainment. It does. And we Irish were lucky because we had the church. And the church, of course, provided the Irish with church schools that gave them literacy. The blacks came to the American cities and had to go to state schools that were the dregs. Further, we got control of the cities while they were still wealthy, and we could put Irish on the city payroll. The Democratic Party in New York City had so many Irish members they had to meet in Yankee Stadium. The blacks got to American cities when they were broke, and they couldn't give themselves any economic advantages thereby. So while we were inferior to the Chinese in our subculture, we were far superior to blacks in our subculture. And so that was a third area of interest to me. I'd been active in the South as chair of Congress of Racial Equality in Richmond, Kentucky, and had been bounced from my first academic post because of my favoritism for black, so-called. And so a third interest for me was to look at the question of race and IQ. And I published the book on blacks in 1980. I updated it in 2008. But I also published a book on Chinese Americans, how their peculiar subculture had favored them in terms of educational achievement.
You talk about how the intelligence is making it easier for us to deal with the complex world around us.
Yes.
Is that what's the causality? If we're getting more intelligent over the last 100 years, and presumably before that, I don't know if it's presumably before that, but is that in so that we can cope with this more complex world, or is that enabling this more complex world?
It gives us the potential to think our way through the world, but that is counteracted by two contrary tendencies. One of which is the new visual environment that young people are in that discourages them from reading serious history or serious literature, which is why I published the Torchlight List, to convince them they would actually enjoy doing it. And they are better capable of looking for logical flaws than people were 100 years ago. They are better at perceiving mistakes in logic. They are better at linking abstract concepts with logic, which should make them better in criticizing scientific findings and data. But against those two trends are the fact that universities don't train them in critical intelligence. They become highly specialized, and just because you know the law of torts doesn't mean that you really have practiced what you need to criticize the modern world. It bombards you with such a wealth of information that it's easy to just turn off. And you have to, in order to absorb the information of the social sciences, you have to know what a confounding variable is and how you would set up a research design to eliminate it, and what a placebo is, and what blind review means. And most of them cannot distinguish good social science from bad social science. So a lot of them just turn off. They're bombarded from every quarter with scientific opinions that seem at variance, and they just say, well, I don't believe anybody, I'm a cynic. Well, that may prevent you from being indoctrinated by the modern world, but it means you can't fight back and establish opinions of your own. So many of the young people today are less political than they were when I was young. Although they may perceive logical flaws better, they are less informed about recent history. They have not read any good history. They haven't read novels, so they don't know what the world is like around the world. And they are no more liberated than a medieval serf. I mean, a medieval serf didn't have the equipment to think beyond what society told him. And these young people may be cynics, but they don't have the conceptual skills and the information and the historical depth of their thinking to really counter the modern world. It's a very bewildering world if you can't find any guidepost to find your way through it.
You have talked about shorthand abstractions, which you've now changed the term to key concepts.
I published a book on this. It's called How to Improve Your Mind, 20 Concepts to Understand to Unlock the Modern World. And people on the right, by the way, found it very useful because a lot of them want to think critically, too. There's a fellow who's a disc jockey. His name, I think, is Smith in Auckland, and he had me on because he enjoyed it. And he doesn't enjoy with a section on economics much because I take issue with him. But the book has a section on how to spot flaws in moral argument. It has a book on when you can trust, a section on when you can trust social science. It has a section on attitudes to science, because many people today are just anti-scientific. It has a section on basic concepts to understand international politics, and it has a section on elementary economics. So you can try and see through when economists are dancing rings around you and telling you things that aren't true. But unfortunately, universities don't give that type of education. You can know a lot about Spanish drama, or you can know French, or you can know a good deal about geography, or a good deal about the law of torts, and you're let loose on the world without having a trained mind to analyze it. And I found that one of the chief confusions among my students was that they were being given conflicting information on climate change, perhaps the greatest issue of our time. So I followed up my earlier books, The Torchlight List and How to Improve Your Mind, with this book on climate change.
Is our world getting more complex?
We are being bombarded with a lot more information. I don't know that in terms of causal factors that influenced how people live, the world is more complicated. They certainly have to do more intellectually demanding jobs today if they're to earn a good living, if they're not to be forced into service work. But they have been prepared professionally for these jobs. It's just that these jobs don't give you the breadth of information and analysis you need. So... The modern world, at one time, people found their way through the world. Fundamentally, they were only interested in national politics, and they were only interested in class interests. In the 1930s, when the Great Depression was on, If you went down a street and the houses were unpainted, they voted for the left. They voted for Roosevelt. If the houses were painted, they tended to vote for the right. And most people found their way through the world essentially by saying, I can't believe that wealthy Americans actually care anything about poor Americans, and I'll vote for whatever society will expand the welfare state. And the wealthier people said, I don't want to pay the taxes for these bums. I don't need the welfare state, and I will resist progressive taxation. And indeed, even New Zealand politics, until the Labour Party was won over by the Freedmanites, was based largely on this. So in terms of the issues that mattered to people, like their purse, they could pretty much trust their upbringing and their habitual voting patterns to find their way. But today, of course, it's very, very different. I mean, America is not just interested in defending itself, it's interested in invading countries throughout the world. And Americans have to get their head around what's going on in the Middle East. It's not something as simple as that Hitler wants to conquer Europe, and that's a bad thing. So I think that the behavior of nations on the international scene, globalism, the facts of climate change, face people with infinitely more complex issues than in the past. Obviously, in the past, there was climate change going on, but no one recognized it. No one thought about it. So it's not that the world is more complicated. We today are menaced by problems that we weren't in the past. I mean, take the Middle East. When Europe was being fought over by Catholic and Protestant, Islam didn't raise some huge army and go in to take sides and try and get the oil. So we were left to fight out our religious battles over the 30 Years' War. Now, that did kill half the population of Germany. But eventually, Catholic and Protestant got tired of killing each other and went on to other things. The Middle East is now, as dictators lose their hold, involved in a war between Sunni and Shiite. But rather than being allowed to fight it out, Western armies keep coming in and killing lots of extra people and, you know, taking one side or the other side. And they're not allowing the Middle East to have its own history. It's unlucky they've got the oil, of course, or we would be allowing them to have their own history.
Do we have the critical skills to be able to deal with the amount of information that we have?
You don't have to have a lot of skills to read a book that I recommend in the Torchlight list by Howard Fisk, which is called The Great Crusade to Save Western Civilization. And it's a history of Western intervention in the Middle East ever since the British and Russians started competing over Afghanistan. And everything we have ever done there has been counterproductive. Oddly enough, just as if there had been a Turkish army running around in Britain and France, it's very unlikely that they would improve the situation. No Western army in the Middle East has done anything except get a lot more weapons among the people in the area and kill a lot of people. And when they left, history went on just as if they were a little mark in the sand that the ocean had marked over. And everyone should have known that the notion to nation build in Afghanistan was idiotic. The British fought three Afghan wars. The Russians fought one Afghan war. They killed a lot of Afghans, and they got a lot of people killed, but they never united the country. That has to be done internally. And now we're amazed by the fact that when the Americans leave, the country is probably going to fall apart again in terms of North and South. And the Afghans will go right on having their own history all over again.
When I was in the States and Canada a couple of weeks ago, it was when the basketball coach, Sterling, the Clippers basketball coach, said
yeah, the owner.
Crazy
thing. He wasn't a player. I don't think he ever played.
No.
He doesn't look like the type.
And it's sort of like, I don't know what the process of getting that to the world's attention was. But for a while, the internet, the media was totally obsessed by this thing. And there were a few just little voices saying, hang on, what about the sort of the everyday slights that add up to more than that, that go on all the time?
Those slights certainly exist. They're not like when I was a kid, where a black could be in the 20s lynched in the South for buying a car that was more expensive than a white neighbor. I mean, it's not like it was in those days. Yes, the slights exist. Though remember, the Chinese had a lot of slights too. And the Irish, when my father was young, he faced the No Irish Need Apply ads that said, No Irish Need Apply, Black Man Preferred. The Irish were considered more violent than the blacks and more rebellious. I think that the level of personal discrimination in America is about a fifth the problem. And four-fifths of it is black history and black subculture. And it's slowly improving, but they carry a heavy weight. For one thing, you have the idiotic war on drugs, which means that one-third of black males between 18 and 24 are convicted felons. I mean, it's an insane situation. It's as if, you know, a third of Irish males had been arrested on charges during Prohibition and were convicted felons. And once you decimate the male side of a subgroup, the women have no viable male to marry. They end up as all solo mothers on the poverty line. So blacks, I think, there are structural features there, like the war on drugs, the failure to get blacks into decent education, the failure to give aid to solo parent homes. I frankly feel that these are about five times more important than the slights black find in everyday life. Now, I'll give you an example that they exist. Many corporations think that they're holier than thou in hiring. And an experiment was performed where they sent out 5,000 corporations credentials. They took all the want ads in the Boston and Chicago areas. And they sent in four sets of credentials, and none of these people would let you mention race. And they, most of them were convinced they were equal opportunity employers who wanted to hire blacks. But on the applications, you could use a name like Jamal, which was a sure tip-off that it was black, or David. And they sent in two matched sets of credentials that were superior with black and white sounding names and two that were ordinary. Well, the whites got 50% more callbacks. And obviously there is an ingrained prejudice there that when you see that it's a black credential. And interestingly enough, the whites that did want to hire blacks didn't seem to care whether they were superior or inferior. They seemed to want mainly a token black. So you can say if you were an ordinary black, that was slightly in your advantage, I guess. You got fewer callbacks, but they didn't look at your credentials as discerningly.
Okay, climate change and sustainability. My favorite definition of sustainability is that it's ethics expanded in time and space. And what I want to know is, does the standard critical ethical thinking, does it work when we expand it over those sorts of scales?
Many things disillusion you when you study climate change. I've always preached against materialism to my students, that is, defining themselves in terms of possessions. And I would still continue to do so, because every one of them that doesn't want a 10,000 square foot house and a car every year and wants to serve people and to be humane, everyone votes with their feet. The more of those people there are, the better off New Zealand is. On the other hand, I feel that climate change may well derail the world in terms of industrial productivity. Now, if only I could turn everyone into a humanist who would share with the third world despite having a lower standard of living. Nothing the matter with that. If you reconcile yourself to the fact that the first world is not going to share with the third world, and about the only way people are going to come out of poverty is that industrialization keeps marching on, and some of it manages to filter its way into the third world, you're in the ludicrous position of saying, I want the world's gross national production to continue over the rest of the century. I mean, it's not my ideal, but it's probably the only way I can see. You know, these nations in Africa, they could have 30 times our output before they would come up to the average level of a New Zealander. So if you don't want to see these, and further, they don't have middle class aspirations. Africa is the really one part of the world, along with a few others, Southeast Asia and India, we're going to breed ourselves out of space. Africa will probably quadruple its population by the year 2100, and it can hardly feed the people it's got. So if you want Africans to use birth control, you have to change them into people with middle-class aspirations. Rather than having six kids so one will still be alive and protect you in your old age, you think, well, gee, you know, my kids are going to grow to maturity, and I want to have only a couple of kids and get them through school. So you really get in a strange situation where, despite my anti-materialism, I want the industrial machine of the world not to fall apart. I would prefer that there is industrial progress that filters into Africa and gives them the aspirations, which would mean you won't have this terrible terrible population explosion.
But how can we do that?
Well, climate, of course. It depends what model you use. I have read Pelkey, who has written a wonderful book, and he has shown that while some people are climate deniers and they're out of touch with reality, and I think their position is becoming increasingly indefensible, the only respectable climate denier position said carbon in the atmosphere won't in itself raise temperatures much. It would have to create a lot more water vapor. And most physicists agree that when you put carbon in the atmosphere, it does mean a lot more water vapor. And water vapor is responsible really to 3/4 to 9/10 of the temperature rise. So that's a crucial question. Well, recently, scientists, in fact, it was published last week, have shown that since 1970, water vapor in the atmosphere over the United States has increased by 2 trillion gallons. Now, that's only 3 to 4% of the total, but boy, is that a lot to create a greenhouse effect. So I think that increasingly the evidence is against the climate skeptics. But then there are the people who won't face political reality. They seem to really believe that using carbon credits and trying to get governments to build windmills and bring in solar panels is going to reduce greenhouse gases in time. Well, all the data shows that by 1950, you'll have passed the point of no return. That is, even a couple of degrees of warming will mean that the tundra will begin to melt, and it has huge stores of carbon that will escape. And also the glaciers will recede, and the glaciers being glass reflect a lot of light. And that would set up an irreversible feedback mechanism. Rising temperatures, less glaciers, more rising temperatures, more tundra melt, more rising temperatures. We could cut our emissions tomorrow, and we'd probably only postpone that by about a decade. So, and further, the nations aren't, you know, they talk about we will cut by 20%. They've never cut at all, except in Russia. That is, Russia had such an economic collapse it did decrease its industrial output. But none of these nations are decreasing it, and the reason is politics. If you were Obama, you only won by 4 percentage points. Would you have gone to the American public and said, now look, in order to cut climate emissions drastically, you people are going to have to give up about, 10 or 20% of your standard of living over the next 3 or 4 decades at about a rate of, 2% a decade. When his opponent is a climate denier, and people don't want to hear that message. Or if you were Chinese, you have the rural poor ready to kill you because they now realize from their kids who go to urban centers that a good life is possible. Are you going to say to them, well, we're not going to industrialize China, you're going to have to stay in rural poverty another 40 years? The other set of deniers are people who are alarmed by climate but won't face the fact that the usual things like windmills, and they're all good. I mean, the more of them, the better. But they're not going to turn climate emissions around before we reach the point of no return. And once you reach the point of no return, glacial melt and the melting tundra and climate rises will probably match, according to the Oxford model, to 6 degrees by 2100. That would melt the entire Greenland and West Antarctic ice sheets and mean an ocean level rise of 12 meters. Well, you can imagine what that's going to do to industrial civilization. That is, most of the cities are on the coastline. You're going to be retreating from the coastline with great loss.
If you're saying that's not enough, is this point of no return and the collapse associated with it, is that inevitable?
No, they have to face up to climate engineering, which no one wants to do. But the best form of climate engineering is Salter. Rather than these lunatics who want to put mirrors up in the sky or to put, iron pellets in the oceans are already poisoned enough without iron pellets. He has the only viable form of climate engineering. The ocean at present sends up lots of sea spray, and these lighten clouds and cause them to reflect heat. And he wants to put a fleet of ships out there with turbines that double the amount of sea spray. And most of the calculations show that that would stop climate rises in their tracks as of this moment. And we wouldn't even get a 2-degree rise by 2050. So if you stop climate rise in its tracks at this moment, then you have an extra couple of generations to look for really clean fuel. And by clean fuel, I mean hydrogen fusion, which is not like atomic fuel, which, creates all sorts of radioactive products. Rather than splitting the atom, it condenses hydrogen, so it forms water and helium. And this creates enormous energy with only water as a byproduct. Now, we're probably about 30 years away from a commercial prototype. But 30 years from now, we'll be past the point of no return. So what you need, while we freeze climate in its tracks through Salter, you need to push this research in California. And fortunately, the European nations are setting up a research facility in the south of France. And the one in America uses laser fusion. You bombard the hydrogen pellet with lots of laser energy. The one in the south of France will use plasma. They heat plasma to enormous degrees, and that causes the hydrogen pellet in the middle of it to implode. And the hope is that if we have commercial prototypes sometime by, let's say, 2050, and have frozen our temperatures at the present moment, we can get that stuff to replace the world's energy supply over the next 50 years. And then you can start setting the ships home again. That is, at that point, we can actually have not much atmospheric carbon.
But we're pretty clever, and your argument would be that in some cases we're getting cleverer.
Well, I hope we're clever enough to get laser or plasma fusion going.
Are we clever enough to not necessarily do the technical things, but to do the social things? We live in currently with a massively inequitable world.
Yes, and with people,
and we buy stuff for on the cheap, kind of knowing that's being made in a slave shop somewhere.
Well, I'm trying to do an end run around that. I mean, that's the problem we've got. Everyone wants a growth economy. No one wants to see their standard of living diminish. The only way you can have a growth of economy, until maybe the Africans have middle-class aspirations and aren't living in poverty, the only way you can have a growth economy is to freeze temperature at its present level through climate engineering, so that the increased number of emissions we're going to put up over the next 50 years can be kept from growing up. And then at about the 50-year point, you can't keep, climate change forever, because the ocean stores carbon. And you can always say, why don't we just put more and more ships out there and enjoy ourselves with oil? But the oceans are becoming acidification of the oceans is going ahead, which may destroy the food chain from the ocean. So you only want those ships out there for the minimum possible time. Now, if we get fusion energy, that is cheap energy that is almost infinitely available. I would like to think we don't use it for everyone to go insane and have a stable of 10 cars and 3 airplanes. but at least we could go on increasing our ability to pile up toys until 2100. And if at that point we have really clean energy, we can send the ships home and have a debate. And we can say, do we really want to do this crazy stuff?
Okay,
because eventually, the Earth may run out of rare metals and things. I mean, you can't exploit the Earth forever. There are rare metal supplies in Greenland, fortunately, that still exist.
I mean, that's kind of my point. We're so clever, and we've done so many good things.
Yeah.
Yet we're blinkered to that sort of
sure.
thing.
Sure. You mean, am I optimistic? No, I feel there's a chance. That is, I think I'm presenting a third way, which means that you could at least write a scenario that would get us out of this mess. And that scenario would be commercial prototypes for clean energy by 2030-50, have them in mass production to do away with all carbon-based fuels by 2100, hold the temperature down in the meantime with climate engineering. Thanks to this industrial progress, set Africa on the way to middle-class aspirations to peak our population. Are there a lot of ifs in there, aren't there?
We're clever enough to write that scenario.
At least it's coherent. I mean, it's not what we're doing. I mean, what we're doing is just crazy. There's no chance at all of it's working.
Okay, we've got 5 minutes left. Are you an activist?
I ran for the Alliance twice, and we were as green as the Greens were. We had a carbon tax on it, and a carbon tax is a lot better than carbon credits. Carbon credits get into a real mess. A carbon tax, Hansen, who is one with me on this, Hansen was worshipped by many environmentalists until about 10 years ago. He said, we're not going to make it. We've got to have climate engineering. And since many of them worship nature and don't want to interfere with it, they turned against Hansen. But Hansen made a brilliant suggestion. He said, when you have a carbon tax in a country like New Zealand, it will, of course, raise the price of fuel, but give all the income from the carbon tax back to the average person. So all of that income is available so that they don't notice a lowering of their standard of living. Now that, of course, is not enough. A carbon tax is not going to prevent. And you'd have to do it all over the world, of course. And China is not about to have a carbon tax because they're putting 300 coal-based energy systems into operation as we speak.
What challenges do you have for the next couple of years?
Well, the next couple of years, I want to join the people. And there are a growing number of them. I see that James Lovelock has come out. He, of course, despairs completely. He takes the view you do, that we're too stupid to do anything. And he's writing about that the best thing we can do is to make ourselves more like robots that could survive climate change and keep our cities cool and, you know, somehow retreat into there. So he's not a very constructive ally. But I want to join those people who say we cannot let this research into clean energy. You know, the House in America always wants to terminate their funds. They're only interested in simulating H-bomb tests. And half of them are climate deniers anyway. So I want to make sure that people like Warren Buffett and you and I are willing to contribute to a fund to see this go on. We can do things in New Zealand, by the way. The Norwegians have a system whereby when a vigorous river hits the ocean, you can put salt water and fresh water into two huge tanks with a membrane between. And the salt water attracts the fresh water and contributes a great deal of power. Six of these in New Zealand would mean we would not have to rely on coal. You could do away with coal completely. Now, I don't know that we have six rivers that would qualify. I suspect the Waikato would. And I suspect the Clutha would, but that would be more detailed experiment. So I am an activist in the sense that I'm going to hopefully get to every member of parliament a copy of my book. I'm going to suggest they follow the Norwegian example. I'm going to suggest that they do introduce a carbon tax. I'm going to suggest that they contribute to a fund to keep nations from exploiting the Amazon and destroying all of its trees. But I'm also going to suggest that they get on board with climate engineering. Because climate engineering plus the research on clean fuel is the ultimate solution. The other things just sort of keep the ball rolling downhill slower.
Okay, and lastly, and goodness, just quickly, do you have any advice for our listeners? Anything you'd like to see them do?
In the book, they will be told the things they can do. But the main thing is to petition their government. That is, the main thing is to say, contribute some money to save the Amazon. Contribute some money to further this research. Try and get on the Norwegian bandwagon for limiting our own fossil fuels. They will find about 6 suggestions to things they can do.
Thank you very much. You've been listening to Sustainable Lens on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM. This has been the show for the 15th of May, 2014. Our guest tonight was Professor Jim Flynn. Your host was Professor Samuel Mann and me, Shane Gallagher. Our music is sourced from the Free Music Archive, and you can get podcasts of previous shows on sustainablelens.org, where you can subscribe on iTunes or norar.org.nz. We hope you enjoyed the show.
This program was first broadcast on Otago Access Radio and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.